This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's a done deal. The sustainable growth rate is no more.
Well, Mark, in one of the few shows of bipartisanship, the Senate easily put a stamp of approval on the so-called doc fix.
I think it's a good idea to take a look at what the SGR have been replaced with, Margaret.
Well, under the bill, the current reimbursement schedule would be replaced with payment increases for doctors for the next 5 years. Existing payment incentive programs are going to be combined into a new merit-based incentive payment system, while other alternative payment models would be created.
So, Margaret, the law looks to establish more incentives for quality care versus quantity of care, and experts predict it will help rein in Medicare cost over time.
Well, to do that, Mark, you need systems that are very good at harnessing health data and using that data to inform and improve best practices, and that is something our guest today is passionate about. Dr. Q Ree is Vice President and Chief Health Director of Integrated Health Services at IBM, where he's responsible for health benefit design and is also the medical advisor to Watson Health, IBM's cognitive computing system. And Laurie Robertson, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, will be looking at the latest numbers on America's uninsured population. And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Q Ree in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. More than a doc fix has come about with a repeal of the sustainable growth rate. The bill passed in Congress and signed by the president ensures clinicians treating Medicare patients also focus on the quality of care. The repeal of the sustainable growth rate, or SGR, has been replaced with a formula that gradually increases that compensation over the next 5 years while the system shifts towards one that rewards for quality of care, not quantity, as well as better management of the chronically ill population. The law also continued the funding for the Child Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, for 2 more years. The ratings are in and reviews are mixed with Medicare's new ratings system. Only 251 of thousands of hospitals received a 5-star rating in the system, which is attempting to make shopping for health care a more transparent experience. A number of the nation's leading hospitals scored rather middling ratings, while specialty hospitals and lucrative surgical specialties tended to do better. All of the rankings can be found at the Hospital Compare website. And Google Glass, coming to a bedside near you. The wearable headgear field-tested by so-called Google Explorers may not take the public by storm, but could conceivably become a common fixture in the clinic or even emergency room. A pilot study at Rhode Island Hospital in Providence allowed ER docs to test the use of Google Glass, which is a head-mounted computer with a camera feature to capture images of skin rashes and lesions in the ER, share those images instantly with a dermatologist or other specialist, and get an instant confirmation of diagnosis. Ordinarily, a specialist has to be paged, which sometimes leads to hours waiting in the ER. According to this first targeted Google Glass study, patients and clinicians were both satisfied with the result, almost 97% trusting they were getting an accurate diagnosis via the Google Glass video. While telemedicine is becoming more prevalent in hospitals and ERs around the country, the technology is expensive and can also take up significant room. While a Google Glass comes in at around $2,000 per unit and is worn like a pair of glasses. Next up on the Google Glass in the ER study, cases of poisoning or stroke. Results from this study were published in the April 15th edition of JAMA Dermatology. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Q Ree, Vice President and Chief Health Director of Integrated Health Services at IBM, where he's responsible for health and health benefit design, is also medical advisor to Watson Health, IBM's learning computer system that's gone from winning Jeopardy to assisting patients and clinicians in the healthcare arena. Dr. Ree was Chief Public Health Officer at Health Resource and Service Administration, HRSA. He also served as Director of the Office of Innovation and Program Coordination at the National Institute of Health. Prior to that, Dr. Ree was Chief Medical Officer of Baltimore Medical System, Inc., and before that, Medical Director at Upper Cardoza Health Center in Washington, D.C. Dr. Ree earned his Master's of Public Policy at Harvard and his medical degree from USC. Dr. Ree, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
You know, I want to get the names right here because, you know, we've sort of been following Watson, and Watson won the Jeopardy, and then Watson went off to medical school. So do I say Dr. Watson or just Watson?
Just Watson.
Oh, okay. That's good. And I know you've been coming off a very busy week at the annual HIMSS conference, and that's the largest annual gathering of providers and professionals in sort of a rapidly growing health IT space. And IBM chose that conference to announce the latest iteration of Watson in healthcare arena. I think you guys stole the show. Since winning Jeopardy, Watson has been enhanced to this powerful tool in health data aggregation and dissemination. And how have these latest developments advanced the use of Watson's artificial intelligence capabilities in the healthcare arena?
Well, Mark and Margaret, what we're looking at is, in the healthcare arena, a real urgent situation where costs continue to rise, quality is oftentimes mediocre, patient satisfaction is often not where it needs to be, engagement is also poor. So one of the exciting things that we're talking about is this new age of cognitive computing and how we can bring in cognitive computing and Watson's capabilities to the healthcare arena to address this crisis in healthcare. We've had a long history of working with doctors and providers, from doctors and oncologists at Memorial Sloan Kettering, Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, and we've been working together with them over the past several years in looking how we could transform how medicine is both taught and practiced. So it's exciting to see now how Watson can address the challenges in the healthcare arena.
Well, Dr. Ree, I think given your current work, but this background as a primary care physician yourself, and you have done the work of being a National Health Service Corps scholar, of being a primary care provider, and also being a leader in community health centers. So you know the urgent need for improvements in primary care and also the intersections between primary care and public health. And you know the kinds of patients that are very challenging in primary care, chronic illness. What do you say to primary care providers, to those physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs on the front lines about what Watson and Watson Health has the potential to do for them?
This is an extraordinary transformation in health and healthcare where we can look at data, provide extraordinary analytics in Watson, and bring the power of this open ecosystem where people can bring data to be able to get deeper insights into the work that they do. And I think about, as a primary care physician, I used to have 15 minutes per patient, and often half that time is spent documenting the visit. And it's often so challenging to be able to go through those records and to be able to, of course, listen, which is, and build that trust relationship with the patient. What's exciting about what we're bringing here today is the ability to take advantage of all that data that currently exists in many different silos, connect it together, apply smarter analytics to it, and support that physician to do their job better and address what I often refer to as the quadruple aim of reducing costs, improving quality, improving the experience, and increasing engagement.
As people sort of look at how one manages big data, And that's been really the emerging themes in the IT world. But you've announced this new partnership, and it's really exciting, with Apple and Johnson & Johnson and Medtronic and others. What challenges have you encountered in trying to bring together all of this data with the new partnership you've created with Watson Health?
You did highlight these extraordinary partnerships, these important partnerships with Apple, with Johnson & Johnson, with Medtronic. If you look at what they provide in the open ecosystem of HealthKit and ResearchKit with Apple, the ability that Johnson & Johnson has in the area of prevention and wellness, how Medtronic leverages its medical devices and its tools to provide important information to patients and doctors. These partnerships are essential to what IBM is about, looking at ways in which we can connect data to get these deeper insights, so that fundamentally what happens is the doctor has the right information at the right time. We believe that the power of Watson will bring many other partners as well.
You know, one of the things that has struck me about this work from the beginning has been your focus on taking every medical journal or healthcare journal in the world and programming Watson to absorb that, you know, mega terabytes of information being programmed in there. And I sort of make the analogy to the provider with their tablet or their laptop. How does Watson come into play at what you imagine in terms of that kind of real-time access to information? What does that look like for patients and providers today?
So as I reflect in looking at even the data at a broad level from community health centers at a national level, and you can see certain measures of success of how well your physicians are tracking evidence-based guidelines for diabetes or looking at the prevalence of obesity. Typically, when you look at evidence-based guidelines and you look at actual results, and there's a broad range of factors for that. There isn't enough time. The average physician needs like 20 hours in a day to do all the things they're supposed to do. There's a lot of challenges. I saw this frequently where patients will come into the exam room at later stages of their disease where their diabetes is already causing them to go blind. So the ability to be proactive, predictive, to take advantage of that limited time you do have with the patient. Watson can go through that literature, curate that information with experts, and provide the right information to that physician at the right time. It'll add so much. I can't count the number of times that I recall asking a medical assistant or a nurse to say, could you find out what this other doctor did, or can you get that faxed over to us? Medicine, frankly, has not progressed as it relates to information technology, and now it is. And that data all exists in structured and unstructured ways. And the ability to connect that data and to connect to that clinical evidence that changes every day, and then to provide that insight to a physician in that exam room and really spend more time building that relationship rather than looking for results that's what's exciting.
We're speaking today with Dr. Q. Ree, Vice President and Chief Health Director of Integrated Health Services at IBM, where he's responsible for health and health benefit design. He's also Medical Director to Watson Health. Dr. Ree, one of the interesting partnerships IBM has announced for Watson Health is with Apple's new smartwatch platform, HealthKit, which you've talked about, and it allows consumers to upload their personal health data for research purposes. And could you tell our listeners more about this partnership with Apple's new platform, and what role could it play in scaling up patient participation in health research?
The ease in which now HealthKit, ResearchKit, will allow a doctor and a researcher to share that data to help get deeper insights that can provide better care at the right time is such an important and exciting development.
So, Dr. Ree, we're very focused our work as well on the training of the next generation, and we do that in a lot of ways through our residency training for clinical psychologists, for medical students. Your Watson Health program has a partnership with Johnson & Johnson, I understand, that's looking to offer continued training of healthcare providers in the marketplace. And we'd love to hear more about the plans to utilize Watson for learning opportunities within healthcare, and also to get your thoughts on the impact that Watson is likely to have on the training of clinicians, physicians, but not just physicians, other healthcare providers in the future. How do you see Watson influencing that kind of training and education?
So Watson has been trained by the best doctors from Memorial Sloan Kettering, Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, and will continue to be kind of go through medical school and go through residency and learn. What Watson's capabilities are for this next generation of providers is to bring in what I referenced earlier, the evidence, into the exam room. The medical evidence doubles every 5 years. We know the evidence shows that people are not following all the evidence-based guidelines. And I mean, I recall when as a medical director in Upper Cardozo, I would be dealing with diabetes registries. Do you remember that? You remember them well. Okay. So the registries from those collaboratives, it was just so mind-numbing at times how manual that process was to collect all that data, go through the charts, and report those results. What's exciting is the ability to bring in the peer-reviewed literature, to bring in those evidence-based guidelines that we know do change frequently, and then also bring in the data of the populations you manage or you take care of, the patients, and to bring it all together and to leverage the capabilities and insights from Watson's natural language processing capabilities, its ability to learn, is really where it can help train this new generation of providers.
You know, we've talked a bit about Watson's gathering fitness and other personal health data through Apple HealthKit, but there's much more complex data that needs to be taken into consideration, like genomics and family history or myriad of data stored in disparate electronic health records. Can you tell us about some of these additional data sources and the issues you face in bringing up all of these into the Watson Health platform? And just sort of as a side, you know, is it that Watson is going to sort of be this new generation of electronic health records? Because how do you tap into the unstructured data field, which our current EMRs are not capable of doing? But it sounds like that's something that Watson might have. Is that also something that's on the horizon with Watson?
This is meant to complement electronic health records. Electronic health records are very important. They're what I would call a system of record. You need to record that encounter between a doctor and a patient. What we're talking about now with this new age of cognitive computing and Watson is a tool that is going to be a system of engagement. It's going to continue to learn. It's going to be able to support that physician to make those recommendations. It's going to leverage predictive analytics. So you were talking about the different silos, genomic data, family history, and all that information that you typically have, a social history, a family history that a physician typically takes. And one of the truths that I came on in my evolution, especially when working in community health centers, is that health is so much more than healthcare. So while healthcare is essential, it's these other factors of health, the social. There's lots of evidence that show that the networks that people have often represent their health. People basically lose weight and gain weight and start smoking and stop smoking within their social and family networks. Their environmental factors, where you live, has a huge impact on your health. If you look at any geography, you can see that often life expectancy can vary by up to 20 years based on your zip code. Genomics, of course, plays a big role. And I think we're getting into this age of personalized genomics that's evolving, and that data is going to be incredibly useful. So the ability to connect the healthcare data, which only typically represents 10 to 20% of health outcomes, and connect it with other data in these other factors of health is what this platform is. What's exciting about it, the ability to bring these other determinants of health together and to build and leverage Watson and this open ecosystem and this new age of cognitive computing to build and create systems of engagement to help doctors and researchers do their jobs better and exponentially improve their ability to do their jobs better is extremely exciting.
Well, Dr. Ram, it's what I've been thinking about, this amazing data that you have, and you've talked about connecting it with other data. When you are looking around the country and talking with your colleagues, what are the kind of action networks or partners that you're looking to work with to see this incredible data sort of put into practice for the social good?
One thing I like to bring into play, I don't know if you've ever, the New England Journal of Medicine did this where they looked at the ecology of medical care. They looked at it for adults and they looked at it for children.
Right.
And one of the things they identified with 1,000 people in a month, about 800 of those folks had symptoms of something. And I once again reflect on my time working in a community health center as a primary care physician. And I think of the stories and as well as the statistics of people coming in with end-stage renal disease from long-standing diabetes or breast cancer. And the reality is those folks represent people with symptoms at earlier stages. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the ecology of medical care, people often don't engage with the healthcare system. It's a small minority of those folks. So as we think about partners, you were asking about partners, I of course think of healthcare partners, and we have some of the best, Memorial Sloan Kettering, Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic. We have some of the best non-healthcare partners, I would suggest, with Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, we recognize that health is about healthcare, but it's also about partnering with other that often care about health, like Apple does, and want to contribute to that greater good. And so the power of Watson in this open ecosystem will allow us to build a lot more diverse partnerships. And that, I think, is going to be essential, because diversity breeds creativity. And when it comes to health and healthcare, We need innovation and creativity to address the challenges that we have.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Q. Ree, Vice President and Chief Health Director of Integrated Health Services at IBM, where he's responsible for health and health benefit design and is also medical advisor to Watson Health, IBM's cognitive computing system. You can learn more about his work by going to ibm.com/WatsonHealth, or you can follow him on Twitter at IBMWatson. Dr. Ree, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you, Mark and Morgan.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Every 3 months, we take a look at what we call Obama's numbers, a statistical record of Obama's time in office. And that now includes an update on how many have gained insurance under the Affordable Care Act. The administration says that 16 million people have gained coverage because of the law. That number is based on polling by the Gallup organization and includes an estimated 14.1 million adults who gained coverage from October 2013, the start of the first open enrollment period for the ACA exchanges, through the beginning of March of this year. The other 2.3 million in the administration's total are young adults aged 19 through 25 who previously gained coverage after the law began requiring that insurance plans allow children to remain on their parents' plans until age 26. The National Center for Health Statistics, meanwhile, estimated that only 11.9% of all Americans lacked health insurance at the time they were interviewed last year. That's down from 14.4% in 2013. But it still leaves an estimated 37.2 million without insurance. The NCHS numbers are preliminary, based on interviews conducted during the first 9 months of 2014. The Urban Institute's Health Reform Monitoring Survey looks at the uninsured who are ages 18 to 64. In that age group, an estimated 9.7 million gained coverage between September 2013 and December 2014, according to the quarterly survey. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Depression is extremely common among adolescents in this country, but it's often hard to differentiate between typically teen angst and a clinical condition that requires more immediate intervention. Unfortunately, a teen's level of depression isn't realized until they take drastic action. Suicide is the third leading cause of death among 10 to 24-year-olds, a population that almost ubiquitously uses texting as a form of communication.
So if you're someone who's in pain, you text us, and then the counselor on the other side is not working from a phone, and they're on a screen that almost looks kind of like Facebook or Gmail.
Nancy Lublin is founder and CEO of Crisis Text Line, an instant texting service designed to encourage teens in crisis to reach out for help, which they receive instantly. All they have to do is text the numbers 741-741.
When messages come in with certain keywords in them, they automatically get tagged as high risk. So we don't take them chronologically. If you're at risk for suicide, you're automatically bumped up in the queue and you're like a code red. You get flagged in our system. And the supervisor would determine whether or not this person with the imminent harm.
Since she founded Crisis Text, the word has spread like wildfire. They receive an average of 15,000 texts per day from kids experiencing everything from typical teen dilemmas, such as a fight with a boyfriend, to kids contemplating suicide. Those in most danger are encouraged to take action through a series of channels. Crisis Text Line, an instant, age-appropriate intervention, available free of charge and 24/7, to give kids in crisis a lifeline and lead them to help they need. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.